Our kids have said to us since we've moved to Minnesota, we are far more active than we've ever been anywhere else we've ever lived.
Moving to Minnesota opened up a lot of doors for us.
Just this overall sense of community, of values that, you know, Minnesotans have.
It's a real accepting, loving community, especially with two young kids.
See why CNBC ranks Minnesota number 4 best state to live and work. A great place to work, an even better place to live. ExploreMinnesota.com/live.
I'm Tracy from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Are you a small business owner or even someone who dreams of entrepreneurship? Then check out season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from iHeart Podcasts and Intuit QuickBooks. Join hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres as they interview entrepreneurs sharing insights around starting and nurturing a small business. You won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too.
Planning your next trip? Choice Hotels family of 22 brands has over 7,400 locations and the perfect hotel for any traveler you want to be. Like a Cambria Hotel serving up locally inspired craft cocktails for all my folks who maybe want to meet up and talk about Mad Royals. Check into a Radisson Hotel with flexible workspaces for you drivers who listen during business travel. Or a Comfort Hotel with free hot breakfast, family-friendly pools, and big spacious rooms for the parents who listen with their kids and need a little retreat. What are you waiting for? Join Choice Privileges and start earning points toward your next stay. Find a stay for any you when you book direct at choicehotels.com, where travels come true.
Hey, it's Will Friedle.
And Sabrina Bryan.
And we're the hosts of the new podcast, Magical Rewind.
You may know us from some of your favorite childhood TV movies, like My Date with the President's Daughter.
And the Cheetah Girls movies.
Together, we're sitting down to watch all the movies you grew up with and chat with some of your favorite stars and crew that made these iconic movies happen.
So kick back, grab your popcorn, and join us. Listen to Magical Rewind on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Brought to you by State Farm. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Welcome to Stuff You Missed in History Class from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm Dablina Chakraborty.
And I'm Sarah Dowdy.
And the topic that we're going to talk about in this podcast has been requested repeatedly by listeners, and hopefully you all can stomach a really sad podcast, because the story of the Lindbergh baby kidnapping really doesn't have any upbeat moments to speak of. It involves the kidnapping of 20-month-old Charles Augustus Lindbergh Jr. from his home near Hopewell, New Jersey, in what was called the crime of the century.
Yeah, and it really is tragic, not just because of the kidnapping of a small child, but the baby was not found alive. And in the end, a guy was convicted and executed for the crime, but there's still some uncertainty hanging around the whole thing, and that's probably why people are still interested in it today, because the guy never confessed to the crime, even though he was killed for it.
That's right, and it also spread fear and grief all across the nation as people identified with and really mourned for the two parents, and they were celebrated aviator Charles Lindbergh, of course, and his wife Anne, and their notoriety really made the trial interesting, too, because it was an early example of a major celebrity trial that consumed the public's attention during the time, and you often see it compared to another trial that I think most people will be familiar with, I hope so at least, otherwise I'll feel really, really old, and that's the O.J. Simpson trial, just in terms of the amount of public interest that it generated, so you can tell by that comparison that it's definitely among one of the most famous trials of the century.
Yeah, it is one of the crimes of the century. It's hard to pick just one. We were talking about that when we were titling this podcast, actually. They're ironically several crimes of the century, but this is up there. So we're going to take a look at the kidnapping, the investigation, the trial, and then try to understand why it counted as a crime, a possible crime of the century, too, why it captivated people so much. But before we get into that, we need to talk a little bit about Charles Lindbergh, the famous aviator.
Yeah, absolutely. He was famous for making the first solo flight across the Atlantic from New York to Paris on May 20th and 21st in 1927. And he did this to compete for a $25,000 prize that was offered to whoever could pull this great feat off. And he made the flight in 33.5 hours on this tiny silver monoplane called the Spirit of St. Louis. And pretty much from the moment he landed in Paris, he was an immediate celebrity. I mean, that's the part, I guess, that's really significant to our story here is that he became uber famous in that moment. And some people even refer to him as a hero, a folk hero, at the young age of 25.
But Lindbergh really was an aviator. That's the kind of thing he was interested in, flying planes. He was not out looking to be a super famous celebrity like he became. And he was really quite uncomfortable with a lot of the trappings of celebrity. He was uncomfortable being in the limelight. And that's partly because he was just kind of a regular guy, at least before he made that amazing transatlantic trip. He was born in Detroit on February 4th, 1902, and he spent most of his childhood in Little Falls, Minnesota, in Washington, D.C. He went to the University of Wisconsin in Madison, but left during his second year of college because he did really want to fly and went to flight school and studied aviation after that. And before he made that famous transatlantic flight, he had just been working as an airmail pilot flying between St. Louis and Chicago.
Yeah, but as we said, after he crossed the Atlantic, though, his life totally changed. People started offering him money for speaking engagements and endorsements, so no more flying airmail planes for him. He was a star. He was out in the forefront telling a story. He went on a nationwide tour promoting aviation, and it was on a Goodwill tour to Mexico that he met his future wife, Anne Morrow, who at the time was 21 years old, and she was the daughter of the U.S. ambassador there. And they ended up getting married on May 27th, 1929, after a pretty short courtship.
Yeah, but that really just made him even more famous and pulled her into that fame bubble too, because after they got married, the couple was just constantly dogged by the media, and it said that sometimes they would wear disguises just so they could venture out in public without getting hassled.
Yeah, it was so bad that it even affected the birth of their child. They had their first child, Charles Augustus Lindbergh Jr., on June 22nd, 1930, and the baby was apparently delivered at home because Anne was so afraid that the hospital wouldn't be private or safe enough for them to do it there.
Yeah, so that's really saying something if you go to that level to keep your privacy. But they worked on it full time too, with their living arrangements even. They lived in this remote, isolated spot, 390 acres near Hopewell, New Jersey, to maintain that sense of privacy. And by the time baby Charles was about 20 months old, they were splitting their time between that house on the weekends and Anne's parents' house in Englewood, New Jersey, during the week. So just kind of trying to go back and forth, keep people on their toes, and be as away from it as much as they could.
Definitely. They did change up that pattern, though, on the last weekend of February 1932, and that's kind of where the heart of our story begins. Baby Charles was sick that particular weekend, so they decided to stay at their country home rather than make him travel when he was sick. And they were going to make that work during the week, even though Charles Sr. had to go to New York on business through Tuesday night. So what Anne did is she sent for her baby nurse to come stay with them at their country home, Betty Gow, who was their baby nurse. She was in Englewood at the time. So she came to where they were. So Tuesday, March 1st is when all the action starts to happen, and we'll just give you a rundown of the events of that day, I should say. What they remembered happening. Baby Charles seemed to be feeling a little better. So at 7:30 p.m., the two women rubbed mentholated lotion on his chest and put him to bed. They then pinned blankets down around him so that they wouldn't come off during the night as he slept.
Yeah, and then they both left him to go to sleep. And Anne went downstairs, and Gal went to do some chores around the house. And she went in to check on the baby at about 8 p.m. He was fine. He was asleep. Everything was good. And so she left the room again.
Yeah, and then Charles Sr. came home. He rolled up in his car around 8:20, washed his hands in the bathroom next to the nursery, and joined his wife for dinner by 8:35. Now, just as an aside, during dinner, he did recall later hearing something that sounded like someone dropping a wooden box in the kitchen. So he heard something, but otherwise uneventful.
Yeah, so nothing much happens for a little bit until Gal looked in on the baby again at 10 p.m. He wasn't there anymore, and the blankets were still pinned down where they should be, but there was no baby in the crib. And so she rushed to check with both parents to see if maybe one of them had picked him up and taken him somewhere, but they hadn't. So Charles Sr. rushes out into the rain with his rifle, finds a broken ladder outside of the nursery window, and at that point, they call the New Jersey State Police.
When the police got there, there were several pieces of evidence on the scene. Thank goodness. I mean, you would want to have something to go by, but some of them were helpful, some of them weren't. For example, there were footprints leading away from the home and off the property, which had some kind of pattern on them as if someone had covered them up with burlap or something, some sort of material, to make the prints seem less distinct.
Try to mask them, almost.
Yeah, exactly. So they knew definitely that someone else had been there, but had no way to really track his shoes or anything like that.
Yeah, well, and then there was the ladder, too, the broken ladder that Lindbergh Sr. found outside, and it was uniquely designed to be very portable, made of all these odd pieces of wood, so it seemed like a good potential clue. It wasn't just something somebody had bought at the store. The lowest section, though, had been damaged, maybe broken while someone was climbing down the ladder, and that might have been the noise that Charles Sr. heard at dinner.
Yep. There was also a 9.5-inch wood-handled chisel there. It was probably used to pry the window open.
And last but not least, there was a ransom note, and it was asking for $50,000. And it offered a lot of clues, not so much for the information it contained, but the way it was written. And we're going to read it to you and then give you a few little extra notes on the strange punctuation and the strange spelling. But here it goes. Dear sir, have $50,000 ready, $2,500 in $20 bills, $15,000 in $10 bills, and $10,000 in $5 bills. After 2 to 4 days, we will inform you where to deliver the money. We warn you for making anything public or for the police, the child is in good care. Indication for all letters are signature and three holes.
So if you look at this note, and you can probably check it out online, you'll see that the positions of the dollar signs are in a weird place. They're after the figure rather than before. And the language used in the note pointed to someone who was probably European. I mean, you can tell as Sarah was reading it, she said gut instead of good. And so the police assumed that it was someone who was of German or Scandinavian descent.
Yeah. And so, of course, though, even though the note is saying don't make this public, don't get the police involved, the news of the kidnapping reaches the public immediately and becomes a huge story. There is a manhunt. Everybody is searching for little Charles Lindbergh Jr. And parents with kids about the baby's age even report being stopped on the street by police in question, you know, to find out if this was the kidnapped child.
Yeah, so this is big news. Everybody knows about it. And they received two more notes from the kidnapper, maybe in reaction to this, I'm not sure, in really quick succession. The first one raised the ransom to $70,000. And if you read that note, you know, he says things like, you weren't supposed to go to the police, you weren't supposed to make this public, now I'm going to have to keep the baby until things quiet down. So he wasn't happy about that attention that they were getting.
Yeah, and the Lindberghs were having trouble, though, even though these new notes were coming in. They were having trouble contacting or communicating with the kidnappers. And then something very strange, I mean, definitely unusual, happens. An outsider, this random citizen, steps in to help. And it's this guy, Dr. John F. Condon, and he is a semi-retired 72-year-old New York City school teacher and Bronx resident. And he's just kind of this activist sort of guy. He writes into the newspaper frequently, writes letters to the editor at his local paper, the Bronx Home News, and he's just the civic advocate of sorts and steps into this super huge news story.
Yeah, in a really interesting way. He writes an open letter to kidnappers in the Bronx Home News offering to act as an intermediary in the situation. So what he wants to do, or what he's offering to do, is to facilitate the transfer of the money and keep the kidnapper's identity secret in the process. He also offered to add $1,000 of his own cash to ensure the safe return of the Lindbergh baby. And this was published in the Bronx Home News on March 8th. So big deal.
Yeah, a big development in this whole thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And a still bigger development is that the kidnappers contact him by the next evening. They actually want to take him up on this, and they send him a letter. The letter was confirmed to be real because it had the same pattern of interlocking circles on it as the other letters that the Lindberghs received did. So at this point, the family also gives Condon their blessing to act as an intermediary in the situation. So we see, like, we have a little a plan forming here to get the two sides together.
Well, and it seems to pick up the pace of the whole thing right away because Condon had two meetings with the kidnapper and he used the code name Jaffsy, which was kind of a blurring of his initials, John F. Condon. And he used that to communicate with the kidnapper through newspaper columns. The kidnapper identified himself as John and would send notes to Jaffsy to various meeting points. And so at first they meet Jaffsy and John meet at a Bronx cemetery, and Jaffsy tells him that he needs proof before they proceed with any kind of exchanging cash or anything like that. He'd need proof that Charles Jr. was alive. And so March 16th, Jaffsy receives the baby's PJs in the mail, and the kidnappers demand the cash in 2 weeks. So seems like something's starting to happen.
Yeah, so then they schedule a second meeting. On April 2nd, Jaffsy lets John know that the money is ready, and they end up meeting the kidnapper in yet another cemetery. That seems to be the place that this kidnapper wants
kind
to meet.
Kind of ominous.
Definitely. And Lindbergh is actually waiting nearby in this situation. He's waiting nearby in a car, and the money transfer does occur. At this point, the kidnapper gives Condon a note telling him that the baby is on a 28-foot boat called the Nelly, located off the coast of Massachusetts near Martha's Vineyard.
And so, of course, people are dispatched to go and find this boat immediately. Unfortunately, it's never found. Baby Charles, though, was found on May 12, 1932. A man out walking in the woods came across a badly decomposed body of a child about only 4 miles from Lindbergh's home. And it seemed that the baby had died from a skull fracture, possibly a fracture that occurred on the night of his disappearance. And some people believe that the kidnapper's fall, that noise that Lindbergh Sr. heard while he was eating dinner, might have been the baby.
Yeah, so a tragedy for the family for sure, but the story doesn't end there. There was eventually an arrest made, mostly because the money that the kidnapper had received on that day that they made the exchange was primarily gold certificates, and the Treasury Department had recorded the serial numbers on those. So after they couldn't find the boat in March 1932, those serial numbers were released to banks and published in major newspapers everywhere.
Yeah, and so eventually those gold certificates from the ransom payment started to pop up around the New York area, and so the police were onto it. But in the meantime, U.S. Congress was passing the Federal Kidnapping Act, which is known as the Lindbergh Law, on June 22, 1932, and sadly, kind of poignantly, that's the day that would have been Charles's second birthday. So the law made kidnapping across state lines a federal crime and made it punishable by death at that time.
And it took a while, more than 2 years, but finally investigators did get a break in this case. A service station attendant in New York City recorded the license plate number of a man who had paid with a $10 gold certificate. So they traced the license plate to a Bronx resident, Bruno Hauptmann. And he was a German carpenter who'd entered the U.S. illegally in 1923. He'd married a German waitress named Anna Schufter, had a kid, but in the spring of 1932, suddenly he quit carpentry and started investing in the stock market. So very suspicious. Police arrested him on September 19th, 1934, and found a $20 gold certificate in his wallet, so even more suspicious. And there were other incriminating clues as well.
Yeah, he had about $12,000 to $13,000 in gold ransom certificates in his garage, so that's pretty suspicious. And then he had these sketches of a ladder that matched the ladder they had found at the Lindbergh home, which, as you remember, was kind of a unique contraption.
Yeah, and also concerning that ladder, there also found a missing crossbeam on the attic floor that was actually one of the boards used to build the ladder.
And the only tool missing from this carpenter's tool chest was the chisel found at the crime scene.
And when investigators took the door trim off his son's closet, they found the former phone number and address of John Condon written there in pencil.
So handwriting analysts looked at that scribbled note and looked at Hauptmann's penmanship in general and determined that it was stylistically consistent with the ransom notes that had been sent by the kidnapper. And then, maybe most incriminating, Condon later identified him as John, who he had met in the cemeteries.
Yeah, and in his defense, Hauptmann said that he was holding the money for a friend named Isidore Fisch, who had returned to Germany in 1933 and had since died. But that really didn't help him at all. He was still indicted for murder in the first degree on October 8th, 1934. So Hauptmann's trial began on January 2nd, 1935 in Flemington, New Jersey, and it was really highly publicized, as we talked about in the intro to this podcast. There were hundreds of press, onlookers gathering all around the courthouse as it was going on, and it lasted for more than 5 weeks, with a jury deliberation at the end that lasted for 11 hours.
You have to imagine it was probably pretty hard for them to find a jury in the first place that didn't know about this crime. But ultimately, Hauptmann was found guilty on February 13th, 1935, and he was sentenced to death. And people were so wrapped up in this trial, they were so interested in the case, that there were thousands outside the courthouse calling for the death penalty during the deliberation. So pretty intense.
Yeah, everyone was outraged at what had happened, and they wanted to see what they felt was a fitting punishment for it.
So there was a series of appeals after that. It went all the way to the Supreme Court, but they were ultimately unsuccessful, and Hauptmann was executed April 3rd, 1936. But if you remember what we said in the introduction, Hauptmann himself never confessed to the crime.
No, he said that he'd been beaten by the police and forced to produce handwriting samples that matched the ransom notes. So he kept kind of holding to his story up until the end. And there were some people who really believed him. Some people believed, for example, what the defense counsel had argued, that Condon was somehow involved. I mean, there were a lot of theories out there, I guess, as to what happened. Like a lot of big trials, everyone seems to have their own theory about what actually happened. But regardless, the Lindbergh family seemed ready, if not to put the whole thing behind them, then at least to get away from all the media attention in this situation that they had been in.
Well, and they were concerned about another kidnapping, because they did go on to have other children.
Absolutely. So they moved to Europe for a while with their son John, and they didn't return to the U.S. until before World War II.
Yeah, there's a Time International article that was written in 1999 by Reeve Lindbergh, who was another one of the Lindbergh kids. And she talks about growing up, quote, in the studied privacy and anonymity of a Connecticut suburb with its shaded streets and unmarked mailboxes, and how even though she didn't know her brother, she felt his loss in their sort of cloistered childhood. It's a pretty sad note to end on, but
yeah, definitely. And obviously the family, or Charles Lindbergh Sr. at least, kept coming back into the spotlight at various times throughout his life up until he died in the 70s. But they always kind of sought this private life. And yeah, it's a really sad story.
Well, we don't want to leave you on a downer note like that, though. So we have some slightly related, in a more happy way, listener mail. So this message is from Jamie, and she wrote that she's been listening to the podcast for a while, and she is currently traveling around South America with her boyfriend, and they've been, you know, taking lots of pictures and seeing the sights. So she wrote in, I just listened to your podcast on Saint-Exupéry, and although I've never read The Little Prince, I do have an interesting fact to share with you. A few weeks ago, I was hiking in the Southern Andes Mountains near Patagonia, Argentina. The most famous mountain in this region, which is visible from the town itself, is called Fitzroy. The whole series of hills and mountains around it is very rocky, and supposedly Fitzroy itself is one of the top 5 most difficult rock climbing ascents in the world. Anyways, while on this hike, we came upon a sign that listed the names of the different peaks that we could see from our vista, and one of them is called Saint-Exupéry. I happened to find a little blurb in my guidebook that explained the seeming coincidence. Saint-Exupéry supposedly fell in love with the forlorn and desolate landscape in Patagonia during his many flights while stationed there for the private company he worked for. The landscape stuck with him so much that he even included it in his illustrations of The Little Prince. So she points us to The Little Prince, and you can look at this mountain and compare it to some of the illustrations. They are remarkably similar. Pretty
cool. I've got to reread that book.
Yeah, and focus carefully on the illustration. So I think that's super cool that his geography would influence not only like the desert scene, but the mountains as well. So thank you for sharing, Jamie.
Also, if you'd like to share any of your own travel experiences with us, maybe ones that relate to a former podcast or maybe a future one you'd like us to do, feel free to email us at historypodcast@howstuffworks.com, or you can look us up on Facebook, and we're also on Twitter at Mist in History. We also have several articles relating to flight on our website. One in particular is really interesting. It's What Was Man's First Attempt at Flight? And you can look that up on our homepage at www.howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. To learn more about the podcast, click on the podcast icon in the upper right corner of our homepage. The How Stuff Works iPhone app has arrived. Download it today on iTunes.
Our kids have said to us since we've moved to Minnesota, we are far more active than we've ever been anywhere else we've ever lived.
Moving to Minnesota opened up a lot of doors for us.
Just this overall sense of community, of values that, you know, Minnesotans have.
It's a real accepting, loving community, especially with two young kids.
See why CNBC ranks Minnesota number four best state to live and work. A great place to work, an even better place to live. ExploreMinnesota.com/live.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
This is Amy Brown from Four Things with Amy Brown. Today, healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways that healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, cultural enrichment, and all-inclusive fares. Discover more at Viking.com.